children play. Smiling faces I can see, but not for me. I sit and watch as the tears go by, by, by. My riches can't buy everything. I wanna hear the children sing.
In my bed, far out, filling high. That was Robin Hitchcock. We'll talk a little bit more about him. And before that, that was a tune recorded by myself and my daughter for Father's Day, a cover of As Tears Go By. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 Accra, The Way Farm. We are radio for open ears, and this is the newest installment of a show that I host called Reading is Fundamental. Actually, Funkdamental. It's Funkdamental because this is a show which is all about books about music. We speak to the authors of the books, and often they're musicians, such as today's guest. My name again is Sal Cataldi. I'm a local musician. I play in a bunch of bands, Spaghetti Easter Music, The Vapor Vespers, Space Heater. I'm also a writer. I write for the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Inside and Out, Upstate New York, and Pop Matters, which is where I wrote a review of this book we're going to talk about today. It is a new book by Robin Hitchcock, the great singer-songwriter, and it is called 1967, How I Got There and Why I Never Left. If you don't know Robin, this is from his own bio, the way he likes to put it. He is a rock and roll surrealist. He was born in London in 1953, and he describes his songs as pictures you can listen to. You know, he's influenced by folks like, obviously, Salvador Dali, J.G. Ballard, as well as a bunch of musical heroes, which he kind of stumbled on in the book that he's going to cover. And he first came to attention with his band, The Soft Boys, in around 76 to 1981, with albums Can of Bees, Underwater Moonlight, and he's done a whole bunch of solo albums over, gosh, the last five decades. And his songs have been covered by everyone from R.E.M. and The Replacements and Nico Case to Gillian Welch and even The Grateful Dead. This book is a really interesting one because it focuses on one year of his life, 1967, when he went away to boarding school and really heard confounded by and surprised and delighted by the music that came out that year that really influenced his decision and his life moving forward, which was really to be a singer-songwriter and to work as a musician. So without further ado, we're going to speak to Robin about his fantastic book, 1967.
I have to say, I welcome you here, Robert Hitchcock, one of my favorites musicians and now writers, I guess. I was actually introduced to your work by someone named Doug Hitchcock, who was no relation.
Well,
He's a drummer from Kansas City who was living in Brooklyn at that time. So I have to say, why a memoir? Why now? And why just 1 year?
because I've reached the age where my memories will not be sustained for very much longer.
Right.
So now is the time to download any memories I want to download. And 1 year because there is enough, I think, in 1967 with a healthy dose of 1966 to make it into a book, and because it's probably the one time in my life that I would really like to share with people. So I'm not really interested in sharing much of what happened afterwards, and a lot of that is known. And also, I don't really come out of it looking very good. Certainly, the 70s, 80s, 90s, O's, and none of it would be a very flattering autobiography. But I think 1967, I was not free to make my own mistakes. I was still on the rails of education and family and all the rest of it. And also, it was the year, for a lot of us. Even if you're not in, even if you weren't around then or don't really care about it, 1967 was the year that modern life began. That was the tipping point, if you like.
Well,
Not
also
just
for
politically,
you,
but socially,
for you, what it reminded me is I know a lot of musicians and a lot of artists, they have sort of this foundational year, and that seems to be what it was for you. It really is the year that you found your passion, and made the plan, the life plan that you basically said that you continue to this day, that you how you got there and that you never left in 1967.
Yeah, good point. I forgot to mention that. Yes,
Well, that's what I'm here for.
that's the that's the other reason.
So I had mentioned in my review, I wrote a print review earlier in Pop Matters, which will be linked here, that the beginning of the book really reminded me of Italo Calvino's If on a Winter's Night a Traveler, that like third person, you're writing about yourself in this sort of third person relation,
Oh, I don't know. I think I'm writing in the first person, but I might seem detached.
In the beginning of the book. Before we get to the school, tell us a little bit about your family background, your mother, your artistic father, who actually, as you say, there painted his nightmares and then actually went on to write a rather interesting and successful book, which was almost sounds like a premise for one of your songs.
What, the book or the my father?
Well, I think, well, actually, I would say both as a character, but the book itself, which is called Percy, which was about the first penis transplant.
Well, because my father wrote a novel about somebody who has a penis transplant, I've never actually attempted to go there in a song.
There you go.
Although there may be a lot of implied penis transplants in all my material, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. My parents were both born in the 1920s, so they grew up in the British Empire. They hit adolescence, and then World War II intervened. My mum was still at school. My dad went into the army before going to university and spent 4 years training in Britain in a sort of he never talked about it really. I don't know what it was, but if it was anything like Evelyn Waugh, it was people just being shuffled around on trains in total darkness, in utter chaos.
And my mum was at school being told to eat, they had a bowl of carrots because it would help them see at night. So they always had carrots. And my mother, till the end of her days, always had a bowl of carrots out, raw carrots, but peeled. My father, having trained for 4 years, was then shipped over 2 weeks, or well, not long after D-Day, and he was in combat for about 2 weeks, and then he was hit by a piece of shrapnel in his leg as he was digging a sort of not whatever they had in not trench, but he was digging something, and he sort of flung himself into it, but too late, and his leg poked out, and his leg was hit. Fortunately, it wasn't amputated, but he could never bend it again. So I knew of him as a man with a stiff left leg who kind of had this lurching gait. And I think that must have affected him pretty strongly. You know, he spent 9 months in hospital, never ran again. He'd been a runner. He met my mum at university in the late 40s. She was the first generation of women to go to Cambridge to be allowed to graduate. So they met in Cambridge. And then they lived in the home counties of London and had three children, of whom I was the eldest, really.
So
You
why
know.
don't you tell us a little bit about the set the scene, if you will, for Win Winchester College, which is where this all transpires, 1966 into 67. The gravitas of the institution, 600
Well,
years old.
yes, it's all in the book, so it's hard to summarize, but I would say that it was Winchester College had been there for nearly 600 years when I got there, and it was something that had come out of probably came in some respects out of Winchester Cathedral, which has now been there for about 1,000 years, which is a whacking great grey stone sort of cross-shaped building, a bit like an aircraft carrier, and suddenly in the middle of a valley in Hampshire. And that must have been very striking for medieval people who were kind of lurching around in the mud, you know, and then they'd see this great building in the distance, and smoke would curl up from their various hovels, and there were a few wealthy cardinals or prelates or bishops or whatever who had nice houses in the cathedral grounds. Gradually, that extended to building the college. I don't really know much of the history of it, but it was a sort of extension of that, really. It was more stone and flint and grayness. You know, Britain, it's winter for 9 months of the year. Basically, Britain is basically Scandinavia South. So we do have a summer, but it's not like over here. It's much more, you never know if it's going to be hot or not, and it's very brief. So you've just had these people in eternal gray winter, and I feel like I basically, even though I got to Winchester in the mid 1960s, I still tapped into the eternal gray Winchester of eternal gray winter. Whoops, eternal gray Winchester. That's a good one.
And
Yeah, I tapped into eternal gray Winchester, and you know, all that stone and flint and ritual. Have you ever read Gormenghast
no,
by
sir.
Mervyn Peake? Well, it that I don't think Mervyn Peake actually. I don't know if he had Ordeal by boarding school, but there's some great elements of Gormenghast in Winchester. Anyway, yeah, that's where it was, and I was just, you know, poured into this old ritual-driven medieval society, but we had record players.
Right. So yeah, that's an interesting thing too, the communal record player. Now listening to music is such a solitary experience for most people. You have your headphones like we do. And you kind of set the scene between I believe there were two groups. There were the what was it, the Meatheads and the Groovers, or
Yeah,
what was
those were my terms for them, but
yes.
they were basically, not everybody was in one group, but you could sort of see everybody had a tendency to one or the other. The Meatheads were sort of jocks. They were kind of into the Beach Boys and sport, and and you know, kind of bragging about sex, which they wouldn't have had any, but they would talk about it, and their whole thing was if they could get hold of some beer and cigarettes, well, hey, you know, neither of which are really terrific assets in the long term if you want to have sex, but whatever. No, it was people were still beside behind the starting line at that point, and the Groovers were, I suppose, much more pretentious. They would have had the Ferlinghetti and Ginsberg and you know City Lights books,
Clove cigarettes.
and they would have been much more interested in smoking pot, which again they was not very accessible, you know, and extremely frowned on by the authorities. But
And
and
that
let's
did,
listen to cool jazz.
and
They
that
listened
did,
to jazz, Coltrane and Dylan, you know.
that didn't come into the picture for you until 1968, when I think you said you lost your psychic virginity with weed.
Oh yeah, I mean, I didn't get anywhere. But like all these things, the best thing about it was imagining it. You know,
Well, let's talk about, Well, let's move to the music, because that really is the key part of the book and the salvation for you. So Dylan comes into the picture. He is a huge influence then and now. So when did you first, what were the first tunes that really connected with you? And
Well, again, it's in the book, but the thing is that I, because the source of music at that point was the one house gramophone in the hall, whatever was played on that, because we didn't have access to radio, that kind of got to everybody very fast. And somebody had like a Rolling Stone, which, well, I was sort of played every morning after breakfast for about 4 weeks, 5 weeks, or whatever. I think it was in heavy rotation, let's say, along with the latest Beatles LP and various people I hadn't really heard before, like the Mamas and Papas and stuff. But yeah, like a Rolling Stone came on, and I'd heard of Bob Dylan, but I didn't know who he was. First photo I saw of Dylan, I thought he was a girl. He looked rather cute. And then this voice would come on going, "How does it feel to be on your own?" And I thought, "Oh wow, he's talking to me personally, you know.
Well, a lot
My
of the
family's miles away. I don't know anybody here. I'm in a strange communal world. I have very little privacy. This is terrifying, in a word, and I've been dreading it. It's not too bad, and I'm learning to manipulate people and get around them, and most importantly, make people laugh.
Right.
You know, that I'd have probably done that anyway, but it definitely accelerated the process. I really had to survive, and I had to remain buoyant and not simply disappear. I had to remain a figure, you know.
Often talk in the
And
Oh, I was going to say, you often reference in the book, that Dylan, is the source of perhaps the meaning of life. You had two things
oh
in
yeah,
there.
that's it. Yeah, no. So I sorry, I get it. Dylan, you know, Dylan replaces my parents really in my family. Dylan becomes my direction, my mecca. And then, you know, it's, and then there's the evening again in the book where I hear Highway 61 for the first time and Desolation Row, which is a complete epiphany. And then I carry on marinating myself in Dylan, and you know, I go home for the holidays, and a friend's sister has a copy of Freewheeling, which I borrow, you know. And I'm too young to buy any LPs yet. And then in the autumn term, someone, you know, Blonde on Blonde becomes endemic in the house, and everybody seems to buy a copy. And everyone's listening to Sad-Eyed Lady and Burning Incense. And it's also starting to spread outside of the Groovers. The meatheads are beginning to listen to Dylan, because Dylan is also a pop singer. So, you know, it's not that hard for them to get into it. It's not the specialized world of folk. It's actually, and it was very interesting what seeing people's reactions to that. People could take Blonde on Blonde in a way they couldn't take even It's All Right, Ma, you know, solo acoustic. But the once he had the band there, Dylan was digestible. And
Well,
The whole bloody place was listening to him, you know. And by Christmas, I bought my first copy of Highway 61. And in the autumn, I heard Visions of Johanna for the first time, which was probably what tipped me over into thinking, I've got to do this. I didn't quite know what this was. You know, I just wanted to write that kind of a song.
Well, you also said about, you also mentioned about your dream of going to Nashville, like Dylan, to record. Where, and you are, you live in Nashville presently.
I'm here at the moment. I mean, I'm sort of intercontinental, really. Okay. I'm in London. It's hard to say where I am.
I should reference to you. We are a quarter of a mile from Big Pink. I'm speaking to you. I'm up in Woodstock. It's called West Saugerties.
West Saugerties, where Levon Helm and everybody lived.
Yeah, well, Levon is in Woodstock, but the Big Pink is literally around the corner from me, about a quarter of a mile, and it's presently an Airbnb.
Wow. And it was for sale recently, wasn't it?
It was for sale. A gentleman, a musician, bought it, and he turned it into, an Airbnb. And it's a very period piece. They have like the old telephones and everything.
Oh my God, really?
It's unbelievable. If you ever come in this area, I'm sure he'll take you down the famous basement.
Does it still have the basement? Can you record in the basement?
If you rent the place for a few days. You can record in the basement. He actually. He gives, if you rent the place, he gives a tour. You don't have like free rein in the basement because he does have a little recording studio down there. But I could. That would be a fantastic concept. You at Big Pink. But we can talk about that offline. Yeah. But the other great champion, I kind of came to you myself through Syd Barrett, actually. A friend of mine, and you're sort of the eternal champion of the architect of the early Pink Floyd sound. You know, you've done tours based around his music. So let's talk about Syd. You know, how he came into your musical life and how he continues to sort of resonate with you.
Well, again, in the book, I think my cousin lends me a portable record player. We're now in mid 1967.
Right.
And I didn't hear Arnold Lane when it came out. It wasn't on the radar at school. So one of the records that he lends me with this record player, a little portable battery operated one, is Arnold Lane. And I immediately am magnetized by it. What's this? And I've just got my first guitar my parents have given me. And I listen to the flip side, you know, Candy in a Currant
Bun.
Based on Smokestack. Right, which was original, which is Smokestack Lightning, that Howlin' Wolf song.
Yeah.
Hey, Smokestack Lightning, you know, same riff. Sid takes that riff.
Yeah. That's a pretty good Beefheart.
Well, Beefheart did a pretty good Howlin' Wolf.
Yeah, sure did.
Everything comes from somewhere. And did he? Oh, yeah. So we had, I got my guitar out and I worked out that at least the bottom string gets solo on Candy in a Currant Bun. It's the first thing I actually never learned many guitar solos. I think it might be the only guitar solo I ever worked out. But I couldn't do all the effects, obviously. But and I heard that August 67. And then I heard Emily on the radio. Someone had a radio school. For some reason, we could listen to radio in the sick room. And I heard Emily play, which I thought was lovely. And meanwhile, the guys at school, the sort of groovers and semi-groovers had bought Piper at the Gates of Dawn. That was an interesting one because the Floyd were seen as a pop group. So there was nothing, but the groovers were going, this is jazz. This stuff is jazz, isn't it? You know, and other people were going, it's a catchy song. So the Floyd actually covered right across the spectrum. But they also had the problem, I think, that Barrett particularly faced was that there was a side of him that wanted to be a pop star and a side of him that really didn't respect that and didn't want to repeat what he did and wanted to, everything should be improvised and played for the first time or whatever. Mm. Nobody will know exactly what he wanted or thought, but the Floyd also were caught between the groovers in London who'd sit there and you know, could absorb Interstellar Overdrive and the Jams, mm-hmm. and just the folks in the countryside who just wanted to hear Arnold Lane and Emily. And you know, I remember someone saying at the time they saw them and thought they were dreadful, and you know, out in the woods in Gloucestershire somewhere, mm-hmm. you know, like it wasn't clear, I think, even to the Floyd, whether they were a pop group or they were an mm-hmm. experimental improvisational band, which is probably what Peter Jenner liked about them.
Right.
And I think Barrett was actually on the fault line between those two things. I think it's another reason that he disintegrated was he was sort of, there was pop Sid and there was free jazz Sid. The right. other guys were all right with it. But I think he just sort of, I think that contributed to his breakdown. Right. Anyway, that's my 15 cents on Sid. That record came in 67 and I still listen to it, you know.
Yeah. Well, you also mentioned obviously the impact of Sergeant, which had a cross between all, it sort of had a cross appeal.
Yeah.
So what were your, when did you first hear that?
I may have even bought it on the day it came out, June 67. And I think my parents were staying somewhere. So I feel like I was listening on a portable gramophone. I can't be sure, but I it came in, you know, it came in from every direction and everybody listened to it. You know, the hipsters, the clever boys at school who'd managed to get hold of pop. The meatheads, the, you know, the kind of class dolt who was going to go into the army. Everybody liked it for a different reason.
Right.
You know, Paul and John and George could all be jealous of people liking their other tracks, you know. Whatever it was, there was something for everybody. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, it was a different kind of fault line, I guess. But I liked it. I think what struck me most... What struck me most actually was Paul McCartney's bass lines mm. on things like Fixing a Hole,
right?
Which I then later discovered he'd done something that Brian Wilson had done. He doubled the bass with a piano or something. Or,
oh, wow.
Actually, maybe it's not in that song, but he definitely was influenced by what Brian Wilson was doing. And mm.
And all on Splendid Four, on Splendid Four Track.
Right, yeah, but multiple four tracks. Yeah, so they in a funny way, they were sort of inventing, which is, that's why Giles Martin's been able to remix it because all the subgroups of four track tape still right. exist. So, God, I don't know. I mean, when things go in like at the top, you get things that seem like a peak. I suppose they take a while to build up and then. You know, it's downhill all the way, really. I mean, you look at Renaissance art or something. I don't know that anything's improved on that technically. Right. I don't know how long it took humanity to build up to paint like that and quite where it all went, but it went. And you think, how long did it take them to build up to Sgt. Pepper and where has it gone, you know?
Yeah,
I suppose into a billion home recording studios and... And
a lot of copycat. One of my favorite things is sort of the copycat Sgt. Peppers. You know, everybody had to do a Sgt. Pepper after that. So you had like Chad and Jeremy and, you know, everybody did their giant opus. But the Beatles also come back at the sort of conclusion of your book where the family is all together around the TV.
Oh, yes, yes.
Watching Magical Mystery Tour. So what was that experience like? You saw the glorious black and white version, I assume.
We saw the glorious black and white version. And this was 6 months after Sgt. Pepper. The record had been out for 6 weeks. in those days, especially if you were the Beatles, you could record a song and you could press it up and distribute it within a few weeks. Things that would be impossible now, but that we just, I mean, this, we knew the songs. I knew the songs. My family didn't necessarily, but, and I'd absorbed the songs. So I really enjoyed seeing them. And the rest of it was like a sort of promotional clip, really. But I loved the Beatles. So I enjoyed seeing them marching around. I mean, basically, it was a kind of video that was, it was like a promo video for their, the six songs they'd recorded. Right. That lasted an hour with extra material. And given that they were at their very zenith, it was a good job they did it. The fact that there's no plot or anything hardly matters.
Right, exactly.
History can only be kind to the Magical Mystery Tour. It's like, my God, thank God they did this, you know.
And it's a fantastic album. I mean, the collection of songs is...
And the songs are fantastic.
One of their best albums.
And they're still just functioning as a group. They're just about to divide up into the three songwriters kind of directing their own recordings and not having the whole band on it anymore, you know, and which came a few months later for whatever reasons. Brian Epstein had just died.
Yeah.
I mean, the Magical Mystery Tour, Epstein was still alive when Paul came up with it. I loved it. But then, you know, we saw the next day, everyone said, this is a terrible flop. The Beatles have overreached themselves. It's their own fault for having long hair and taking LSD. And, you know, at that point, none of them had been busted. Paul was the only one who'd actually admitted to taking acid.
Right. So he went on TV and had that interview.
Yeah. And so Paul, and again, I think John was jealous because John had taken hundreds of trips and, you know, just, but Paul was the one who came out and said it. But Paul being the diplomat of the band and being the one who was, in the end, became the mouthpiece of the band because he's diplomatic, you know, and puts a positive spin on things. Paul got the attention, and I'm sure that irked John. I think lots of things irked John because he'd started the group. Anyway, I've had 55 years to think about all this. Back in 1967, I thought, oh, I love it. Oh, the papers don't like it. Oh, gosh. And then 67 ended, you know, that was it.
Well, cool. I just want to say one. I want to, you know, the reason I'm asking you all these questions about the book, a lot of the stuff we're discussing is in the book, is so people kind of go out and get the book.
Oh yeah, yes.
I think it's a great book. The last thing I wanted to touch on in the book before we go on to your music is the cameos in the book by Brian Eno are pretty amazing.
Yes.
So let's hear about the two cameos from Mr. Eno.
Well, the school, as I explained, sort of had two poles. One was the Meatheads and the other was the Groovers. And a lot of the Groovers were centered in the old college that William of Wykeham had founded, the first module of what became what was it, expanded in the 19th century into Greater Winchester College. But the OG college had been there for nearly 600 years in these medieval courtyards, not far from the cathedral. And these were inhabited by the scholars who all wore black gowns and slept hanging upside down from the rafters or on straw pallets. And they all had IQs of 150. Most of them were able to get in free because they passed the scholarship exam. And a lot of them were children of academics. In one particular, Galen Strawson, who's still a friend of mine, who's become a very celebrated philosopher himself and is now at the UTX in Texas. But Galen and his friends they were so evolved they could levitate. They knew it all. If Bob Dylan knew the meaning of life, the people who would, the 12 apostles would have been the scholars. But the scholars in their black robes and all the rest of it, had discovered this other guy who was only 2 years older than them. He must have been 19, who had long hair, receding long hair, sort of straggly blonde hair and blue circular sunglasses. And he was the first true hipster sage that I ever beheld. Mm-hmm. This was summer 67. So, you know, the Ragged Army hadn't formed yet. There weren't lots of people who just, anyone with long hair and interesting decorations was somebody who knew something. They weren't just kind of deadbeats who'd got stoned and wandered around and couldn't be bothered to groom themselves. They did this because they knew something. This guy was at the local art school. He was a student, not a teacher, but he had something of the teacher in him. And he was called Brian Eno. And the scholars glommed onto him, and I glommed onto the scholars. I was just in one of the outside red brick houses, but I wanted to go where those people were going, you know. And it was 1967, it was still, everything was all in one funnel. In Britain, it was called the underground. I'm not sure what it was called over here. And, you know, you would be into poetry, jazz, Dylan, hip Beatles. Your mission in life was to grow your hair and smoke pot, but not just because you were a pleasure-seeking person on a skateboard who wanted to get high, because you wanted to achieve enlightenment. And so this young Brian Eno, it wasn't clear what he did, and actually in a way it still isn't. He's a sort of transformer. He's a facilitator. He ran these two events, and it wasn't exactly clear what they were for. So the first one involved being down in a basement, a medieval basement. He had a Revox tape machine that was playing a Bob Dylan tape backwards, and a stick of incense, which was, you know, incense was the currency of the day, jasmine joss stick, a bloke playing a electric violin, which I think was detuned, but I don't know, and a blue light bulb. I should get a blue light bulb for down here. And the tape played for 15 minutes and the guy droned for 15 minutes. I suspect Eno might have even heard the Velvet Underground at that point.
Right.
There was a touch of the sort of John Cale about it. Mm-hmm. But he'd have had to have got an import copy because it didn't come out in Britain until 68. An important point about 67 was that I'd heard of the Velvet Underground, but I actually hadn't managed to hear the LP.
Right.
Somebody at the school had it, I think. But it was this sort of music concrete event or something. Mm-hmm. And it went on for 15 minutes. And then he said, you know, any questions or whatever. And then he did another one about 2 weeks later where everybody, they got some balloons from the science school. They got some helium. And I don't know if Eno himself got the balloons or somebody else did, but these sort of big silver meteorological balloons. They weren't just like party ones, you know, for kids. They fill them up with helium and you could write a little message on it and send it into the sky. Oh. It was a lovely sunny morning. I think Sergeant Pepper was out by then. And my memory is they were both sunny Sunday mornings in 1967.
Well, so I'd like to switch that now. I'd like to switch now. I have just a few minutes left in our time. To talk about what you're presently up to and what do we have to look forward to from you and Emma, your partner?
We've got a record. I've got a record of 1967 coming out.
Right, companion piece.
It was Emma's suggestion actually that so I've recorded 11 songs from 1967 that were, a lot of them were hits, some of them like the Incredible String Band, whom I also mention in the book.
Wow, love them.
And My White Bicycle by Tomorrow. They weren't hits as such, but there's, you know, White a Shade of Pale and Waterloo Sunset and See Emily Play. And if you're going to San Francisco, I think is the only American track on there. So I've got that. That's being announced in July and it's coming out in September.
Great.
That's called that's got the same cover as the book. But
great.
It's called 1967 Vacations in the Past. and Emma herself has ongoing projects which she will tell you about, but she's got some fantastic stuff in the can that she's just finishing off. So the whole Tiny Ghost Hive is humming. We plan to have there's re-releases. I've got loads of old records. I don't know if you can see the tape. I think they're at the back of the room. But
yes, the masters.
I'm in the basement with the tapes.
That's as
on
it
brand,
should. As it should be.
Yeah,
well,
yeah. So
well,
true to life.
Well, thank you very much for your time. We'll be
Sal. You're very welcome.
Thank you, and we will hear from you in September with that new album, and this show will be up soon, and we'll have a little bit of your music at the beginning and a little bit at the end. And thank you so much for your time, and best
thank
of
you.
Luck.
Thank Ciao. You. All right. Take care. Thanks.
There's a house burning. The hand I'm holding.
I never